Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. A reminder that you can catch all Current State past segments at WKAR.org. The Lansing State Journal's Lindsay Van Hulley reports today that DTN Management is looking at options regarding its gateway project here in East Lansing. Plan A was for a six-story structure with retail and a new drive-through Bigby Coffee. This, remember, is the location of the first Bigby, you know, the Bigby, and before that it was Arby's, and then I think it was the bus station or some combination thereof. This is on West Grand River, downtown East Lansing. Their original plan also included 160 apartments, 280,000 square feet, six stories. Some of the negative feedback they've got to this involves the height of the building and real concerns about noise and traffic. So apparently DTN is looking at options. According to the story, it does not necessarily mean that the original plan is dead, but they are exploring options. Later this hour here on Current State, a peek at this weekend's Lansing Electronics Extravaganza, spearheaded by the Michigan Antique Radio Club. That's always fun. And MSU Provost June Hewitt is also coming up. It's been 4 weeks since our next guest proposed a series of five debates with his opponent in the race for the U.S. Senate from Michigan. Democratic Congressman Gary Peters made the proposal. He will likely face former Republican Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land in November, and to update us on the debate proposal and to field other questions, Current State welcomes back U.S. Congressman Gary Peters. Congressman, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's great to be with you, Mark. How are you doing this morning?
Just fine, thank you. What, if anything, have you heard back regarding the debates?
We're still waiting to hear back. As you mentioned, we would like to do a number of debates. We've actually accepted three debates. We've been invited to debate by Wood TV in Grand Rapids with Grand Valley State. We've been invited to a debate at Michigan State University there in East Lansing, and we've been invited to one at WXYZ down in Detroit. I have already accepted all three of those debates, which would be great. We would hope my opponent would do the same, and then I would also like to do a couple more in a couple other media markets, perhaps Traverse City, Flint. So we are out there talking to folks. I think it's critical. This is the first open Senate seat we've had in many, many years. The people of the state of Michigan deserve to hear the candidates stand up on their feet and answer questions and talk about what they're going to do.
I mean, the polling's been encouraging for your campaign. As a practical matter, Congressman, why propose so many debates?
Well, I just think it's just critical that we do that. You know, right now what we're seeing on television is bombarding of out-of-state groups. You know, my opponent has spent close to $10 million in primarily out-of-state billionaires who have been dumping money in this campaign in 30-second sound bites. And you're right, the polling is encouraging. I'm being outspent about 2-1 on the television, yet I'm still up in the polls. But I don't think a race as important as the U.S. Senate in determining who should be the U.S. Senator representing Michigan should not be determined by 30-second sound bites on advertisements, especially from out-of-state groups. It's got to be the candidates talking about issues that are important to Michiganders. The things that I've been hearing is I've been traveling around the state talking to folks from one end to the other and want to stand up and fight for middle-class families.
I want to ask you about the border situation, the border crisis. President Obama has proposed spending over $3 billion on measures to deal with this wave of unaccompanied minors that have overwhelmed border authorities, mostly in Texas. The money would be earmarked to the detention, care, and transportation of these thousands of would-be immigrants, mostly from Central America. What do you make of the president's proposal?
Well, we certainly got to deal with the issue, and the president's stepping up and saying we've got to deal with this crisis. We've got these minors coming across the border, and we've got to make sure that we continue to maintain our border integrity. But we need to get these children back to where they came from, but that takes resources in order to do it. It's certainly unprecedented, but we've got to maintain the border security.
You support the $3 billion figure there, that proposal?
Yeah, I'm still reviewing that as to whether or not I'll support that figure, but certainly additional resources are going to be necessary.
A number of causes have been mentioned for this wave of immigrants who are simply showing up at the border. What is your understanding for the spike in these arrivals recently?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, people obviously are looking for better opportunities and looking for their children and see that in the United States. And We are going to be that beacon as long as other economies, particularly South America and Central America, are struggling. Folks seek what they believe to be better opportunities. I think that's the question.
Is it primarily instability back home, though? I mean, there have been a number of scenarios brought up here.
Well, I think that certainly contributes to it. You know, it's all of those factors that people look to the United States. And the United States has always been a beacon for people. It's throughout history. Folks have come to this country in order to build their life for themselves, for their families, to seek the American dream. And certainly we need to take a good, hard look at immigration policy. You know, I'm supportive of immigration reform. We've got a lot of issues that have to be dealt with. And one of my frustrations here in the Congress is that we haven't been able to pass bipartisan immigration reform. I support the proposal that passed out of the U.S. Senate. It passed in a bipartisan way. Both Democrats, Republicans came together to deal with issues surrounding our immigration policy in this country. Unfortunately, the Republican majority in the House won't even put it on the floor. I'm confident we'd likely see those reforms if we put it on the floor, but we've got a Republican majority that simply does not want to even allow a vote on it.
What might break that deadlock, in your view?
Well, it's hard to say. I can't get into the head of Republican leadership as to why they don't want to put it on the floor, but I think they are concerned about Tea Party, far right-wing elements within their party, and they believe that they're going to be punished if they support immigration reform, but I don't think that's the place where most Americans are. Most Americans, like myself, are somewhere around the center and just want to do some practical problem-solving, fix problems, get things done. But unfortunately, we've got a far right wing ideology that tends to dominate the Republican leadership in the U.S. House.
Congressman Gary Peters is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. Back to the campaign here, Congressman. The Detroit News reported yesterday that your opponent, Terry Lynn Land, has in the past been part of the family real estate business, Land and Company, but now she denies it, possibly to distance herself from family wealth. Are you following this situation?
Well, I saw the story yesterday in the paper. I read it briefly. I just think it is curious that she talked about being part of Land and Company, her family business, which was started by her grandfather and her father, and now she's saying she had nothing to do with it and never worked there, and it's as if there's something to hide. I'm not so sure what's going on there, so we'll have to follow it more closely.
You said at the Mackinac Policy Conference that improving Michigan's economy is job one. Proponents of the Keystone XL pipeline claim there would be a number of economic stimuli that would result from it, not necessarily for Michigan directly, but certainly for the larger U.S. economy. Are you willing to concede that there would be some economic and political advantages to going forward with Keystone XL?
Well, my concern about Keystone XL from day one has always been to make sure that if it's done, it's done with the proper environmental protections. You've got a pipeline that's going to be carrying Canadian oil to the international market around the world, and it's going to cross the United States. And as it crosses the United States, it puts communities at risk with a pipeline. Those of us in Michigan should be fully aware of the potential risk given the Enbridge pipeline break we had in the Kalamazoo area, which was carrying Canadian tar sands oil. I think it's the most expensive pipeline break in U.S. history in Michigan. In fact, we're still cleaning up. Years later, we're still working on the cleanup from that spill. So I certainly think the folks in Nebraska and other states in which this is going to traverse to have a say to make sure that they are putting in place the safeguards necessary for their local residents. And I'm also concerned, quite frankly, about Petco. I dealt with Petco in Detroit, which is the residual from Canadian tar sands. Well, it's considered the dirtiest of the dirtiest fuels. About a third of every barrel of Canadian tar sands oil contains this Petco. It was piled up along the Detroit River. It was blowing into people's homes, into their lungs. It was running into the Great Lakes. And I've proposed legislation to make sure we have best practices in handling this material and, quite frankly, finally get a better understanding of the potential public health risk associated with it.
Some environmentalists, though, claim that pipelines, back to the Keystone situation, some environmentalists even claim that pipelines are environmentally preferable to rail transport, which is expanding. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I certainly want to make sure that we safeguard the environment for rail, and there are certainly concerns with rail as well. We've had some rail disasters up in Canada that we have to tighten some safety regulations. We've got old cars that are carrying petroleum that are not meeting the standards that we should expect. So certainly, I don't know if it's either or. We're likely to use both. You're going to have both pipelines and rail. That is the reality of what we deal with. But let's make sure we're doing it in an environmentally sound way. I've never believed that there's this false choice between safe environment and the economy. I really do believe you can do both. You can do what's good for the economy, but at the same time, safeguard our environment, whether it's by rail car or pipeline. But that's, the fact that we have some issues with rail cars should not be a rush to judgment on a pipeline. That should not be the excuse for that.
Congressman Gary Peters is our guest here on Current State. Billionaire climate activist Tom Steyer contributed $100 million to the Senate majority PAC that supports the election of Democrats to the Senate. You've benefited, at least indirectly, from that. How do you respond to critics who allege that your campaign's being partially bankrolled by a very wealthy partisan activist?
Well, you know, I don't know those linkages there, and I don't think that number is accurate at all. I don't think that's all what's gone into the Senate Majority PAC. But, you know, having said that, what he's contributed to the Senate Majority PAC, I'm not aware of the amounts that he's contributed, and it's hard to comment on that. But I think it really leads to what I think is the issue here, whether it's Tom Steyer or whether it's the Koch brothers who are dumping. We know for a fact they've already put in $6.5 million in Michigan, an unprecedented amount of money in support of my opponent and her anti-middle class agenda. So I think the focus is that we've got too much money in politics from these outside billionaires, whether they're from whatever side they're on, which is why we have to have comprehensive campaign finance reform. There's way too much money in politics. It's going to be a focus of mine in the U.S. Senate is to make the system work better and fair and try to get all this big special interest money out of it. But it's also a reason why I'm pushing for debates. It's like, let's move beyond these TV ads and radio ads and other types of ads that are being put on the air, and let's have good old-fashioned debates where the people of the state of Michigan can take a look at both candidates standing on their feet, talking about issues that they care about, talking about issues that people in the state of Michigan care about, and who's going to be that champion fighting for middle-class families in the United States Senate. That's why it's even more incumbent, with all of this money slushing around, it's even more important that we have these kinds of debates, and that's why I would hope my opponent would be willing to do this, and it's unfortunate she's trying to hide and just let big money speak for her.
The Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision generated an awful lot of response across the country. What did you make of it?
Well, I was very disappointed by that decision. Fundamentally, I believe that women should make the choice of their health decisions and their reproductive health decisions. Those are women's decisions and not their employer.
Congressman Gary Peters will likely face Terry Lynn Land this November for Michigan's open U.S. Senate seat. First time it's been opened open in about 20 years or so. Congressman Peters, good luck. We'll have you back. Thank you.
Well, it's great to be with you, Mark. Take care.
Lansing's Common Ground Festival is off and running. Tonight, Violent Femmes, The Wailers, and at least eight other acts. Guitarist Gary Clark Jr. tonight at St. Andrews Hall in Detroit as well. We'll drop that in. You're listening to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Back in April, the Michigan State University Board of Trustees approved the appointment of June Pierce Hewitt to the position of provost. As provost and executive vice president for academic affairs, she's in charge of academic initiatives here at MSU. She had served as interim provost for more than a year before succeeding Kim Wilcox, who is now chancellor at the University of California, Riverside. June Hewitt joins us today to talk about her priorities as provost at a Big Ten university. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
We call you the chief academic officer. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it has different understandings given different populations. I've heard it described as the dean of the deans. which is kind of a nice nice idea, the leader of faculties. But it primarily gives me the responsibility for providing the academic direction of the institution and aligning all of our resources, our human and financial resources, around those priorities.
That sounds like a job and a half.
It is a job and a half, and it is the best job.
Oh, okay. You did not intend to apply to become provost while serving in the as interim. What changed?
Well, I think I probably changed. I was committed to serving the previous provost, and that was actually great fun. Being second is a different job. There's a different set, maybe not a different set of responsibilities, but a different sense of responsibility, certainly, when you are providing support and assistance versus being the decision maker. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't at all sure that I wanted that responsibility, nor that the university was best served. I've been here a long time, and I thought there was some advantage to bringing in someone who had a different perspective and different ideas. I still value that, but I think during the process of the year as interim, I began to understand the opportunities. If you understood and knew the assets of the university, it really is an advantage in some ways to know the players, to know the opportunities, and to have the relationships already, so that you know who to go to, who can lead, who has the enthusiasm and the ambition. There's some nuance to this job, actually, and so I began to think about what the opportunities might be to be in that role, and decided.
Here you are.
And here I am.
Yeah. MSU Provost June Ewitt is our guest here on Current State. You laid out a busy agenda for your first days, work on a pilot teaching and technology lab, planning a new integrated science building, a healthy campus initiative. Let's go through those one at a time and update us on those, the pilot teaching and tech lab.
Well, I'm hoping next year to bring together, through some faculty leadership, all of the resources that are on our campus around innovations in teaching and learning. Certainly, everyone has been aware of some of the technological changes in instruction. And MOOCs have captured the attention not just of the higher education world, but of those across the country and actually across the world. MOOCs are not going to put Michigan State University out of business, but with any
these are massive open online courses.
Yes, yes.
We'll clarify.
Yes, and that's probably important. People say it and don't know what it is, but there are great opportunities through the use of technology, both in delivering an instruction and learning how students learn. So I'm hoping this year to bring together all of the assets that are in different places on the campus. We have lots going on in online education, and hybrid education is a mix of face-to-face and technology-enhanced teaching. But our assets are scattered, and if we decided to bring those together and to create some real goals around where MSU wants to be in terms of teaching, technology, and space, I think we could really be an international leader in this area.
Sounds ambitious. Is it fair to say MSU's approach to MOOCs has been relatively cautious so far?
I think cautious is one term. I think another is strategic. I don't think that there is anyone waiting out there for one more online introductory physics course. It's just not there. There were a set of people who, some for-profits, some nonprofits, who jumped out really early in this space and have, in some cases, done very well, in other cases not. The conversation now across the country is, who are you going to go with? Which company are you signing up with? We've tried to figure out what's our real comparative advantage. What are the areas in which an MSU MOOC or an MSU online program is unique? Where is our niche? And I think holding back a little bit, it may be cautious, it may just be smart, and deciding where we can actually be a leader is our strategy.
A new integrated science building.
Oh, this is very ambitious. So all of the big problems that are left are interdisciplinary problems, right? There is no save the world problem that will be solved by a single discipline. It really is about bringing people together in interdisciplinary, cross-disciplinary ways to do the research to answer the questions. So MSU is particularly well-positioned to bring together scientists around food security, energy, and the environment. And if you think about the confluence of those three areas, you begin to think about the opportunities for some pretty significant work. We love to have a space where those scientists can collaborate. We don't have that space. We don't have that building. We don't have the funding for that building. But as we begin to talk about what our priorities are on campus, that certainly is one of them. Will that emerge as the next building project on campus? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is worth discussion.
Budget and state funding challenges have triggered some tough decisions in recent years. Small but impactful programs like music therapy, mm-hmm. American Sign Language were cut. Any regrets about academic cuts that have been made?
I don't think regrets in terms of second thoughts. I think regrets in terms of having to let things go because of financial concerns. But I think one of the advantages, if you can call it that, of that tough decision-making time is that I think the campus as a community understands that there cannot be any more business as usual, that we will never come to that place again where the state provides 75% of our general fund. We will always live in this state of having to, not the state of Michigan, this condition where we have to be critical about where our resources go.
And are other administrators and faculty getting that message? Are they absorbing that message? And is that a part of their evaluations and decision-making processes?
I think there's some administrators, some faculty, some colleges, some units that understand it very well and who every day think, is this the best use of the resources that we have? And what are opportunities to capture other resources externally? So much grant and contract activity, a lot of entrepreneurship on campus, and that's good. That's the way we will have to live in this new environment. There are other places who still wish that we could go back to the good old days, and I understand that too. I was hired in those in a time when faculty believed that they would have an opportunity their entire lives to pursue the work that was most important to them and that they would be well cared for. And so the contract has changed a little bit. And faculty understand that to do the work they most want to do, it may require finding external support to help do that.
Professor William Penn's classroom tirade got a lot of attention when a video was posted on the internet. He was later reassigned. This was a anti-Republican tirade that stirred all of this up. Were you involved with dealing with that, the aftermath of that?
I was, and those were in my first days. That was kind of
welcome to your new job.
Yes, and that's okay because it was grace under pressure, I hope. Those are difficult decisions. Those are difficult circumstances. I have so much respect for my faculty colleagues, but we make very different decisions under different circumstances. And so trying to be respectful of the freedom of faculty to teach and do their work in the ways that they believe is appropriate, but thinking about the institution, the institutional reputation, but more importantly about the covenant we really have with our students to create an environment where they can learn, where they feel safe, where they believe that they're respected.
And this episode jeopardized.
Well, it did. And too. For me, that was the principle that was used in the decision making.
The focus that this event took on our program was that you saw two campus traditions colliding head on. One, academic freedom. The other, an atmosphere of civility. Is it fair to look at it that way?
I think it's quite fair to look at it that way. certainly civility writ large, but then again, the environment, the learning environment for students, and at what point is that jeopardized because students are concerned about being able to express their own thoughts and to speak freely.
Mm-hmm. June Hewitt is our guest, Michigan State University Provost. It's no secret MSU has been under federal investigation for its handling of sexual assaults on campus. How does that? Are you involved in that? And if so, what are your plans regarding services for student victims of sexual assault?
Well, I think we're all involved at some level, and I think we all assume some shared responsibility for the kind of environment we create going forward. I think we're all very concerned about not just how we respond to students when there has been some incident that causes them concern, but how it is that we prepare students to live on this campus and to respect one another. And that's where a great deal of our attention is going. Students really need to understand when they step onto this campus what our expectations are for the ways in which they interact and treat one another.
The university's planning to hire more investigators. Do you know if there's a plan to hire more sexual assault counselors or victim advocates to keep up with the rise in reporting?
Well, I think we feel as if we can redeploy resources in that area in terms of early response to individuals. I think the investigations and the investigators is much more technical. And while we have people who are very well prepared in our counseling center, in our health center, in our clinics on campus that can step up and be prepared to work with students who have concerns, I think we need to assure everyone that we will be much faster to respond in investigating allegations. And that's really where I think the criticism has come. It's really been about speed.
MSU has one of the highest percentages of Chinese students in the nation. This has created challenges. How would you improve the experience for everyone here at MSU given this rise?
That's a great question, and a question that is being asked and answered all across the country. And in fact, frequently, individuals from other places are calling MSU and asking how it is that we're doing it, because we've really done some things in terms of food service and campus support in our residence halls that other universities are trying to emulate. We're going to spend some time this year thinking about that, actually. That's on my list of things to do. I think we did some good work last year in our orientation programs. For the first time, we did some things that perhaps better prepared our international students for the expectations on campus. We also did some work last year in helping our faculty adopt and adapt classroom strategies for working with international students, and not just working with international students, but creating classroom environments that were inclusive of students. And that went very well. So we're going to expand that this year. Faculty are very interested in thinking about how it is that you work in these classrooms now that are much more cosmopolitan than they were. I came here 32 years ago. My graduate students were primarily from Africa at that time. That's not the look of the campus any longer. And mm-hmm. so making sure that we create, again, classroom learning environments where everyone has a positive experience and the faculty can do their best work is the goal. So we'll think about that.
There is an enormous ongoing debate as to how best to educate public school children, not just in Michigan, but across the country, traditional public schools, charter schools, homeschooling. How does this debate play out in your office? How does that impact you as provost of MSU?
It has some very, very significant impacts. First of all, we have a dean of the College of Education now who is very concerned about education, educational quality, particularly of low-income students. And I think his state leadership, I mean, he's a national leader, but I think he can have some significant influence on what happens in Michigan. For us, we see every day, and it's our challenge, we see very, very capable students, students that we want to bet on as being successful, who come to us with significant academic gaps in their preparation. They have come from schools where they did not, they're not really prepared to do what they're being asked to do at an institution like Michigan State University.
That sounds like a serious problem, challenge.
It is a serious challenge, but we are working hard. We have a number of programs to try to help students really catch up and have had some remarkable success. We're seeking funding now from a number. We have funding from a number of agencies, but we're seeking additional funding from some Michigan foundations because we have been successful in helping students, particularly in quantitative skills, catch up and to do it fairly quickly. But it's resource intense. These are bright students, and they can do it with good instruction done well, but it is not inexpensive.
June Hewitt is the provost, the chief academic officer, the dean of deans. Here, we learned another title for what you do here today. June Hewitt here at Michigan State University. Many thanks for joining us.
You're so welcome.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. The 29th annual Vintage Electronics Extravaganza gets underway this weekend in Lansing. The Michigan Antique Radio Club spearheads the gathering, which is one of the largest of its kind in the country. There will be between 200 and 300 sellers with a diverse mixture of vintage radio and telephone and other electronic items on display and for sale. And WKAR's Peter Worf checked it all out. What'd you find out, Peter?
Mark, I'm here on your radio show, and what I'm about to say may shock you. I really love old radios. So when I found out about this a year ago, I thought, boom, perfect for Current State.
Sure.
A chance to go see old radios, and this year, more recent electronic equipment, solid-state stereo that's now, quote, vintage, video games from the early days of video, and we'll find out about that more from Mark Oppett, who I got to know last year, who's a collector and a vintage radio parts distributor. That's another story in itself, but Mark and I got together earlier this week, and he told me about the Vintage Electronics Extravaganza, and starts off just explaining what it is.
Well, first of all, it's a flea market. The flea market opens at 7 a.m. on Friday, and it goes till about 11 a.m. on Friday, and then we have an indoor auction from 1 to 4. And then we also have flea market on Saturday all day. But it's, first of all, it's a flea market, and then it's also seminars indoors, and we also have the auction, and we have a social hour for collectors to get together. In conjunction with us, by the way, this year is the Telephone Collectors International, and they are a totally separate group, and they have their separate area inside, and they're just happen to be at the same location as we are at the same time.
So this would be vintage telephones, I suppose.
Yeah, and I couldn't even tell you anything about what they do. It's like, you know, cat collectors versus dog collectors. I mean, I just don't know.
Different language entirely.
Different language, yes. It's a whole different thing. They're less about electronics. We're about electronics. That's another thing. A lot of people associate us with the old crank-up phonographs, and really our group doesn't get involved in that because that's machinery. It has no electronics in it. So actually, the crank phonograph collectors are more likely to be clock collectors because it's fine machinery. Right. Yeah.
And what we'll see at the electronic extravaganza is really the heart of it is really around tube radios. And just everything else radio is there from a $10 tabletop to something really very high end.
That's right, yes. You know, I mean, you'll see the total range from, really radio begins around 1920. And our range, we come up to maybe around 1990 in products. But we are expanding now into vintage audio equipment, so solid-state audio equipment of the 70s, 80s, and starting to be 90s now is collectible.
Yeah.
Also, vintage gaming devices have become collectible.
What types of gaming devices might show up?
Yeah, the old names like Atari and whatever else existed in the 70s and 80s.
They're 20 plus years old, so they're starting to come back now as vintage. What sort of solid-state audio might be appearing?
Oh, well, the big names of the 70s and 80s were Kenwood and Pioneer. You know, you see a lot of that. But you'll see Sansui, and you'll see the classic name from the 60s, which is also a tube-type audio, is Fisher. So you see Fisher, Dynaco. Yeah. Those are some of the older names from that time period.
Fisher, Kenwood, Pioneer, and those sorts of things. What makes these solid-state items attractive to collectors and audiophiles?
Well, mainly you have to be looking at the high end of those products because they still really do perform well. So it's really, when you get into the solid-state era, there's a lot of stuff that's the lower line has very little, if no value at all. But when you get into the very top of those lines, the items that at that time sold for, you know, $400, $500, they're starting to sell for $400 or $500 or more again. Mm-hmm. So they kind of lost their value after a while, and now they've come back. So those real high-end tuners, separate tuners and amplifiers, especially amplifiers, they're getting popular again.
Tell me again about the sort of antiques roadshow element to the electronic extravaganza. Well, you can bring items in.
Yes, you can. And we highly encourage the public to bring anything in that they have that's vintage radio or audio or related items. Like even vintage televisions are quite collectible. Certain unusually shaped ones and things like that. And by the way, one of the hottest areas of collecting in that field is the very earliest color televisions.
The world is a carousel of color. Wonderful, wonderful color.
Walt Disney presents
When would those be from?
The very first ones came out in late 1954, and that was RCA and Westinghouse. They were the first two ones out. But then other companies came out with them in the succeeding years. So anything before like 1962-ish in color is a collectible item.
What were some of those early color televisions looking like? Screen size, the way they were built? What would we see?
The first ones that came out were all 15-inch diagonal. Yeah. And they stayed that way for a couple of years. And then they started expanding. They came out with a 17-inch, then a 19, then a 21, etc. By the time you get up into around 1963 or 4, the 25-inch, what we call roundy, it was actually a round picture tube installed into the cabinet, and the top and the bottom were flatted off. Those were very common. So you see a lot of the RCA roundies from the early 60s.
We talked about the electronics extravaganza at this time last year. What's happened for you in the last year? Any interesting new acquisitions for you?
Yeah, actually, I did come across something that's kind of unusual. I'm not as hardcore a collector as I used to be, in a way, because I've gotten into the parts and restoration business.
You do that online.
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. You know, having been in collecting for 40 years, you know, you start to say, oh, I've seen it all before. But actually, I came across a radio that is made by a company called Silver Marshall. And right when Silver Marshall went out of business, they started another company called McMurdo Silver, and they made really high-end chrome-plated chassis radios. So these Silver Marshalls are just before that, and I found one that is really the predecessor, the very, you know, pre-radio to the ones that were the chrome-plated models. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of exciting to find.
Yeah. What do you like about it?
Just the technology of this particular one. It's not, it has a nice cabinet. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of knobs, a lot of controls, which collectors like. So you can do a lot of things with it when you're tuning. It's just got those kind of sexy features that, and the fact that it's so obscure. I mean, it's a thing that I just haven't seen before. And I've been to a lot of shows, and these just do not show up. I mean, other models by this company do, but this particular high-end model just really doesn't show up. I found it in Flint. Yeah. It was on Craigslist.
Yeah.
And they just said, you know, Silver Marshall Model Q. And I'm like, Silver Marshall Model Q?
Yeah.
Really? I'll take that.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Mark Oppett of the Michigan Antique Radio Club, and we're talking about the 29th Annual Vintage Electronics Extravaganza, which is this weekend in Lansing, Michigan. And we're discussing our love of beautiful old radios and fun and quirky features on those radios. So thanks for doing this today, Mark.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a cotton tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in a penny arcade.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. Being Wednesday, it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. Today we feature the Carefree Dental Clinic's new Pay It Forward program, which offers dental care in exchange for volunteer service in the community. Here to tell us more about Carefree Dental's Pay It Forward program, Audrey Taylor, the dental clinic's administrator and project coordinator for Pay It Forward. And joining Audrey is Megan Barrett, director of public relations for Carefree. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us here today.
Joining us, Audrey, how does the Pay It Forward program work exactly?
Pay It Forward is kind of designed in order to serve low-income patients without dental insurance. And as opposed to giving them dental services for free, we ask them to do something to earn the dental services. So they're going to go out into the community and volunteer hours within the community organizations in order to earn those dental services.
And you modeled this after a similar program in Battle Creek, I'm
yes,
told?
That is correct.
Okay.
And Battle Creek was super great. The Calhoun County model let us come in and observe their operation. They gave us all of their paperwork materials to kind of organize that to work for us, and they were very helpful in helping us getting the program started here.
And Megan, you recently completed a pilot program. How many participants did you have?
We did. That's actually a great question. Audrey and Christina worked in our office together to complete that pilot program. I know Audrey probably has those numbers a little bit more than I do.
We actually completed 9 patients for the pilot program. Our goal was to do 10, so we were right kind of on board with where our goal was for the pilot program. And we had 8 dentists in the area, eight local dentists that volunteered their time to serve those nine patients. And with those nine patients, we were able to achieve over 100 volunteer hours within our community. Many of those hours were with the local Humane Society, which I was very excited about because I love animals. So that was, it's pleasant seeing the different places that these people are going and volunteering their time for. We had some of the volunteers even within Carefree. We were working at trying to make our place a little bit more beautiful, and some of them came in and did some painting and some floor work to help us out. So that was great too, getting them involved in Carefree as well. And then we were able to provide over $8,000 worth of dental services to those patients.
We're talking with Audrey Taylor and Megan Barrett of Carefree Dental's new Pay It Forward program. What services are available in the program? What's not available, Megan?
Sure. So there are a list of actual services that are available. Oral health education, exams, cleanings, x-rays, and fillings, and simple extractions are what is available in the program. We don't offer the dentures, crowns, and implants, unfortunately, just due to the priciness of some of those that has to go on for that, those services for the dentists themselves. Mm-hmm. But overall, you know, to maintain your oral health, this is a great program to do that. This is a great program to get in. If it's someone that hasn't had dental insurance for years, which a lot of us know when it comes to paying your electricity bill or buying groceries or dental insurance, you're going to opt for groceries. If you haven't had it for years and you just need to get back in that routine and you need to figure out what's going on.
How do you distinguish, though, between your patients that you want involved in the Pay It Forward program and the others?
For the Pay It Forward program versus our Carefree Dental program,
yes,
our Carefree Dental is geared towards below 250% of poverty, but we also take patients who have Medicaid or who have the new Healthy Michigan plan. And we, for those who don't have those, we provide dental services at a very reduced rate. The Pay It Forward program is only for uninsured patients, and it is no charge to the patient. And so we're really reaching that population that maybe doesn't qualify for Medicaid or MyHealth, but, you know, they, whatever else is going on in their life, they can't afford that extra $20 to pay to have a extraction done at our clinic.
But are you basically negotiating with patients here? You need a filling. We would like you to get involved X number of hours at some particular project. Do you have discussions like that?
What we do is we first ask the patients to come in to Carefree and sit down with us so we can talk to them about the program and what it's about. And then we give them a list of about 80 organizations where they could choose to volunteer with.
Okay.
And then once they have that list, they can kind of decide what type of volunteer hours they want to do. And they'll do four initial hours as well as an oral health education class.
Yes, tell us about that.
We sit down with the patient for about a half hour, and we go over how to maintain their oral health, how to incorporate healthy routine
hygiene.
Care. Yeah.
Yeah,
the importance of oral hygiene, what gingivitis is, what periodontitis is, and how those things can impact them if they're not maintaining their oral health. So we can also educate them and get them on board with taking responsibility and maintaining their own oral care to prevent some of these major problems coming along again.
So
that's one thing I really love about the program, is that we're really trying to also educate this population about how to prevent these major problems. And then once they've achieved their first initial 4 hours, they get an exam, a treatment plan, x-rays, and a cleaning. Mm. At that point, they would get a treatment plan of, you know, that you need this many fillings or this many extractions. At that point, we tell them, based on that treatment plan, you need X number of hours to serve in payment for that treatment plan.
Okay.
And then they go back out into the community and they do the remainder of their treatment hours, and then we get them back to their office, which they are seen at the private practice dental office for those procedures.
Audrey Taylor and Megan Barrett are our guests here on Current State. They are both with Carefree Dental Clinic's new Pay It Forward program. Megan, where do the dentists come from? Are they all volunteers?
They're all volunteers, and they're all through the Greater Lansing area. And we are looking for more dentists. If there's dentists that are listening that want to volunteer their time to do this as well, I mean, we're just kicking this program off, and we're really hoping not only to spread the word about Pay It Forward, but to spread the word about Carefree in general. We offer medical services, dental services, behavioral health, optometry. We have all of that in Lansing and the Mason area. Mm-hmm. So, but in that, yeah, we're looking for dentists that are willing to volunteer their time. But they, right now, the ones that we have, they're all in the Greater Lansing area. So they're just throughout the communities.
And now that the pilot program is over, what's next, Audrey?
Our next hope is to really get the community to embrace this project. We want volunteer organizations to know about us, to be letting their volunteers know, you know, if they come in with a toothache, oh, well, you know, there's this Pay It Forward program. You're volunteering with our organization. Let's get you the dental help that you need. Or, you know, county health departments and emergency rooms, Sparrow and McLaren, you know, we want those places to know about us so they feel like they have a source to help this population.
Where does your funding come from?
Some of our major funders have been Granger.
A lot of the funding comes specifically for Carefree in general, as well as this program, from different grants throughout the community. Okay. Locally, Granger right now is our top funder for this. They were gracious enough to see what this program can do. They're a very community-minded organization and gave, you know, a large amount of funds to kick this program off and to really jumpstart it and to work with the pilot program. It's not often you can find people that want to grant a pilot program to see how this is going to work. And they were very willing to do that. So, you know, that's a huge step for us. But in general, we take private donations as well. So if anyone's interested in learning more about this program, they can call our offices or at 517-507-3999. But just to learn about Carefree too, carefreemedical.com gives a lot of information, and there you can donate as well.
And we're just about out of time. Volunteer opportunities here available beyond the dental professionals?
Yes, absolutely. Carefree Medical and Dental is always accepting volunteers. I did want to mention, too, that Central District Dental Society has been very instrumental in helping get us dentists as well.
Audrey Taylor is the administrator of Carefree Dental Clinic and the project coordinator for its new Pay It Forward program. Megan Barrett is director of public relations for Carefree. Thanks to both of you and good luck.
Thank you
so much.
Current State could always use more nominations. We know there are people in orgs out there that are doing great work, but we need to find out about them. Just help us out. Tweet us suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll visit some of the GM sites of the Racer Trust. We'll also have our first of a new monthly segment where we check in with the Citizens Research Council of Michigan to discuss current public policy issues. That's all coming up Thursday. You've been listening to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. See you tomorrow.